To another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. In my life, I've sort of moved in and out of formal Buddhist practice and identification with Buddhism and being a Buddhist. I don't know where I am anymore. I used to be pretty deep, and then I kind of went awry, and now it's part of the picture. It's part of the room. It's part of the practice, but I try to avoid identifying with it one way or another. But one consistent factor in my, I won't even call it a journey, let's call it a kind of careen through spiritual practice and thought, is the work of Stephen Batchelor, our guest today. I can't remember which of his early books I read first. Stephen's been a very productive writer with a deep background in a formal Buddhist practice from a number of different traditions, living as a monk in Asia, you know, doing the full do. And yet in his later work, and even overlapping this period, developing an increasingly vocal secular Buddhism that resists some of the sort of inherited concepts and sensibilities associated with traditional forms of Buddhism, and really remaking, reframing, reshaping, reviving elements of the Dharma for a secular age, which are all issues that have become much more central in the last 5 to 10 years as Buddhism and particularly mindfulness practice has entered the mainstream world more and more vividly. So these issues and these questions about what would be a secular Buddhism, what is a Buddhism appropriate for today, what do we need to regain and rediscover, what do we need to keep, what do we need to possibly toss over the into the drink as the ship of Dharma plunges into our increasingly bizarre future. And Stephen's latest book, After Buddhism, Rethinking the Dharma for a Secular Age, might be my favorite of his works, though I still have a soft spot for Buddhism Without Beliefs, a book I reviewed in the late 1990s and then was very important for me as I made my way from kind of a formal identification with Zen towards a looser engagement with the Dharma. But this new book is wonderful because it weaves together two very different strands. One strand is a very clear kind of presentation of his notion of what the core elements and practices and attitudes of a secular Buddhism would be. His Buddhism is pragmatic, down to earth, skeptical, uninterested in the metaphysical questions that drive a lot of contemporary spirituality and indeed still drive a lot of Buddhism, very much engaged with the practical conditions of the world, but also recognizing its enigmatic and tragic core. And at the same time, also woven through this book are a series of portraits of some of the original followers of Shakyamuni, of the Buddha, as Stephen is also deeply well-versed in the earliest writings of the Buddhist canon, the Pali canon, is very, very interested in early Buddhism. And indeed, part of the argument of the book is that if you go back and look at the sources correctly, or at least from a certain philosophically and historically informed perspective, you can see that that the Buddha was a secular thinker from the get-go. That's his sort of radical argument, and that the supernaturalism, the mystical signs, the peculiar body, the powers, the cities, all of the things that we come to associate with Buddhism as a religion, with its own kind of ideas about supernatural powers, otherworldly effects, that all of that it can be seen in a way as cultural accretions on a core approach to life that is at root pragmatic, skeptical, ethical, and deeply engaged with our ongoing conundrum in a way that works just as well for us today as for folks 2,000 and plus years ago. So with no further ado, Stephen, thank you so much for joining me on Expanding Mind.
Well, thank you, Eric. You summarized that so well, my work and my current book, that I don't think I have a great deal more to say, to be honest.
Well, we'll see about that. Well, one of the things that I was thinking about, one of the reasons this book really worked for me was that even though you are clearly deeply informed by contemporary scholarship in the history of Buddhism, you know, these are scholars who are trying to get an quote unquote objective view of what we can really know and say about the historical conditions of the Buddha in his time, that at the same time you are writing as a Buddhist. You are writing with a kind of investment that most scholars don't have, or at least don't want to acknowledge in their writings. And in some sense, you're presenting something that we see often in the history of religion, which is the idea that the current state of the religion is in some ways mired in routine and dogma, that it's lost the spark, it's going awry, it's lost the thread, and that the way to restore it, or the way to bring out spiritual fruit from the somewhat desiccated tree, is to go back to the origins and retell an origin story about the beginnings of the path. I mean, we see this in Protestantism all the time, that Protestant dissenters would say, God, we've got to get away from this Catholic stuff, or even we got to get away from this Presbyterian stuff or whatever. We have to go back once again to the way it was in Christ's time and around Christ in order to reframe what this thing is, and in a way to rediscover a new way by going backwards. You could have written a book that was just that was more about the Dharma today, where it's like, what can we take from this tradition? How do we bring it into our modern life? What do we leave aside? But you're clearly driven in a very deep and, to my mind, very evocative way towards retelling a story of the origins of the Buddha's original time. What is that about? Why do you have that investment or that interest in the origin story, retelling the origin story?
Well, I think this goes back to something very central to my own quest, as it were, my quest as a human being. I mean, Buddhism is peripheral to that. Buddhism is just a means to an end. And I think what I'm concerned with fundamentally is not demonstrating that Buddhism is this, that, or the other. I'm interested in asking and trying to resolve the question of what it means to be human. And to me, the Buddhist tradition serves as a means whereby to come to terms with that question. I do feel that the Buddha pursued a very similar sort of trajectory. He starts with the questions of birth, sickness, aging, and death. His awakening, as I understand it, is actually some kind of resolution, some coming to terms with what that means. And I think his teaching is basically a vision, a practice that helps others to likewise engage more fully with those questions. Now, in that regard, I'm sorry, I've got a bit of a cold. In that regard, my involvement with Buddhism over the last 40 years has really been a kind of a conversation or a dialogue with the tradition itself. In other words, when I study these early Buddhist texts, I'm not interested as a Western academic would be, in trying to sort of pin down what they might mean in terms of the language, in terms of the philosophical era in which they were written, and so on and so forth. I'm interested in these texts because they speak to me. In other words, I hear what they're saying. Sometimes I pick up a text, it doesn't say anything to me at all, so I put it to one side. I try to listen to these texts in ways with which I can then engage in a kind of a dialogue and a conversation. And this process, which started back in the 1970s when I was a Tibetan Buddhist monk and studying later Mahayana works, very much set in motion this kind of inquiry. And over the intervening years, this question as to what is the Buddha trying to say? Who was this guy? Why am I so drawn to him? This has led me further and further back to what we broadly accept now as the earliest record we have of what he said. We find it in the Pali materials, we find it in equivalents in Chinese, we find fragments in Sanskrit and Tibetan. But the Pali materials, probably the most accessible to an English-speaking public today. And so my quest for meaning, my quest for value, purpose, significance in human life has been very much achieved. Achieved is actually an ongoing process as I speak. Through a kind of living conversation with this character, Siddhartha Gautama, the person we know as the Buddha. And so my writing is not a detached philological or kind of quasi-scientific study of a set of historical documents, but it's actually an ongoing record of my own engagement with this particular person, the Buddha. But of course, I'm not interested in this in a purely solipsistic way. In other words, you know, what does it say to me in the privacy of my own experience? I'm concerned with what it has to say to the conditions of our time, the conditions of our world. And I think what, in a sense, qualifies the Buddha, and one could say the same about Christ or any great historical figure, Socrates would come to mind as well, is that these characters, although they live at particular times and places in history, are somehow able to transcend their particular historical milieu and are able to speak to the human condition as such, what it means to be fully human, what it means to live a flourishing and authentic life. And it's in that context that my writings are really just putting into written form the the results, the inquiries, the tentative conclusions I've been making along this journey, which has now basically taken up the whole of my adult life. So that's kind of how I see it. I see all of my work really as a work in progress. And that what you read now, I hope in the next book or the one after that, if I live that long, will take it further still. I don't see it as an end point. I'm not interested remotely in trying to sort of establish another kind of Buddhist orthodoxy, even if we can qualify that as a secular Buddhist orthodoxy. I'm not interested in orthodoxy. I'm interested in dialogue. I'm interested in conversation. I'm interested in questions. I'm interested in seeing where all this goes. I'm interested in how these ideas translate into how we think, how we speak, how we act, how we do art, how we engage in relationships, how we negotiate the political, social, economic world in which we live. That's all that matters in the end, is how can I live fully in this moment, informed by my own insight, and also that insight as it has been developed and assisted and provoked by, in my case, the Buddhist tradition.
And one of the ways you talk about that sort of end goal is a life of human flourishing in this world, you know, setting aside all of the transcendental impulses that are so widely distributed in religion and philosophy and just in people's hearts and minds. And with the Buddha's teachings, you also provide a way to reframe and reorganize them in some sense or rethink them, partly through the work of translating the terms that you decide to use for the terms that are normally, let's say, translated as suffering or desire, or words that we generally leave untranslated, like nirvana. And, you know, there's tons of this. We could spend the whole rest of the time talking about these points. But in one of the, I think the good things about your book is that because you're so rooted in the history and you are rooted to some degree in the philology, is that even though you're not doing that as a scholar, it gives you a certain heft so that when you come in and reframe these things, when you say, let's not talk about the four noble truths, let's talk about a fourfold task, that, you know, I'm really ready to take it on and see what you mean by it. So I'd love to just give people a little bit, a little taste of that reframing work. Probably that I think that's a probably good example of it, is mm-hmm. what is somewhat, in your view, distorting or unhelpful about thinking about what have been traditionally thought of as the four noble truths as truths rather than as parts of a task or parts of a process or a practice. That shift already seems to indicate, it gives us a little information about what you're trying to do to open up this material to make it live for people today.
Okay. Well, you see, I think what happened is the Buddhism started out, well, I don't even like the word Buddhism, to be quite frank. The Dharma started out, I think, as something probably more similar to the kind of philosophical work that people like Socrates and Epicurus and the Stoics and so on were engaged in roughly around the same time in Greece. This was a practical philosophy that had to do with actually putting into effect exercises, what we would call maybe meditations in Buddhism, but also a critical way of thinking that would actually lead to a positive, transformative experience in one's own life. What happened, though, in my opinion, is that quite quickly Buddhism became roped into the project of becoming another religion. And what I mean by that is a bastion of a certain set of certainties. In other words, most people, well, I don't know about most, but many people on earth find life to be profoundly unsettling and scary. And they're looking for something that will give them a kind of a bulwark against that kind of uncertainty. They're looking for truth. They're looking for conviction. They're looking for somebody who knows everything. So the Buddha gets elevated into this godlike, omniscient person who understands the past, the present, and the future, which is your standard Buddhist view, and has delivered a bunch of truths. And if we were to believe in those truths, then our lives would somehow be resolved, would be saved. And if we live a life according to our belief in those truths, then that will lead us to some kind of comparable emancipation or liberation. Now, I fully understand that for many people, that gives them an enormous amount of consolation, an enormous amount of confidence that they can maybe, cope with the world a little bit better. But frankly, I think it deeply compromises what the Buddha was actually on about. I don't think the Buddha's message is remotely consolatory. It's not trying to sort of give us some kind of some sort of comfort in the face of suffering. It has to do actually with giving us the resources in our own lives to come to terms with suffering. And this means to look it in its face. It means to embrace it. It means to say, yes, I've been born. I'm going to get sick. I'm going to get old. I'm going to die. That's the bottom line. That's our existence on this earth. It ain't going to last long. We don't know how long, but it ain't going to last long. How can I live that brief period on earth in a way that is fulfilling, in a way in which I can die, hopefully with a sense of accomplishment, I hope having lived my life to the full? That's what matters to me. And in this way, I think the Four Noble Truths have been developed into really a kind of metaphysical dogma, the foundations of a religious belief system. And also, I think, they become the foundation for establishing a hierarchy of power. In other words, those who have access to this truth or these truths are those who know what's going on, who are in the right, and therefore they have authority over those of us who fail to understand these things.
One aspect of that power structure and that authoritarian dimension, of course, is the focus, the traditional focus on monastics. And one of the things that you do in the book that, again, is very eye-opening, you know, I had my, you know, sort of vaguely and decently informed view of what the Buddha's life was like and who his followers were and who the important followers were. But I hadn't really done the deep research, but I, you know, I had some sense of it from many readings, many, you know, secondary sources, being a Buddhist, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And I just did not. And what your book gave me is that the characters around the Buddha who you profile in these chapters, where you give us a wonderful sense of the time and place and the historical forces and the kings and the markets and what was actually happening, very much informed by contemporary scholarship, you know, in terms of cleansing the lenses of the old myths. But you focus on people who were not monks. And indeed, I walked away with an extraordinarily different sense of how much room there was in the original or in the Buddha's own time for people who did not adopt the precepts of monastics and indeed stayed and indeed flourished in the world and also suffered in the world and had their own problems and their own failings as well. So it's part of what it sounds like your project is about is not just opening these questions up again for us today, but also in a way making an intervention into the politics of these questions.
No, that's absolutely right. You see, I think the very fact, I mean, we have to acknowledge that given the social economic conditions of the Buddha's time, the only people who really had the opportunity to dedicate themselves to these sorts of ideas and practices in a sort of full-time way were people we now call monks. Now, as you've noticed in my book, I refuse to call them monks. I call them mendicants, beggars. And I call people who were not mendicants or beggars, but followers of the Buddha's teaching, adherents. I don't call them lay people. As soon as we set up this dichotomy, monks and laity, we've already set up a load of suppositions that simply weren't the case at the Buddha's time. We think of European monasticism, Christian monasticism, and we think of the monk as the expert. The lay person, the laity, is obviously not the expert, the person who has to, you know, look to the monk for some kind of guidance or authority. But when we go back to these early periods, we find that that monk-laity distinction is really not as pronounced as later Buddhist tradition would like us to believe. But of course, it is undeniably the case that the texts, for example, that I refer to were preserved because there were communities of mendicants, people who were working full-time in pursuing these ideas and practices, and they were the ones who memorized these texts. Now, I think we have to be quite honest here in recognizing that obviously the texts that they would privilege would be the ones that would present themselves in the most favorable light. They were concerned not with the lives of people living out in the world as businessmen, as doctors, and so on and so forth. They were concerned, obviously, with people like themselves. And so I think the canon reflects that bias unavoidably. And I don't think there's much we can do about that. But when we go rather more carefully into these early texts, we find numerous passages, and they're scattered here and there throughout the canon, in which we find people who were not monks, not mendicants, but people who were working in government, people who were merchants, people who were doctors, who the Buddha acknowledged as having achieved degrees of enlightenment and realization, and who lived in the world from that perspective of insight, and who seemed to live flourishing lives in a way that was just as much an embodiment of the Dharma as was the lives of those who live more detached from the world. And so I think in our day and age, when I suspect very few people, even if they're interested in Buddhism, will be drawn to becoming a celibate monastic, we need, I think, to recover role models, figures from the earliest texts and the earliest period around the Buddha who lived flourishing lives, and yet we're not monastics. And I think it's quite revealing. And I'm glad that you picked up on this. I think that's what my book is very much trying to do, is trying to recover a sense of the Buddha's world that is not dominated by rather otherworldly monastics, but is inhabited by the whole of human life. Every people from all kinds of backgrounds in the world, all of whom were engaged with the practice of the Dharma, all of whom were embodying what the Buddha calls the Eightfold Path. I mean, remember, for example, in the Eightfold Path itself, which, if anything, is one of the most central and foundational teachings of Buddhism, you have right in the middle there the idea of right livelihood. Now, monks and nuns don't really get involved in livelihood. And yet the Buddha presents that as a very central part of what he considers to be his teaching. But when we look into these texts and we try to find out more about what livelihood means, there's very, very, very little information. What we find in more and more are the kinds of things that would have interested monks. We find a lot of philosophy, we find a lot of psychology, we find a lot of instructions in meditation and so on, which reflect, once again, the monastic bias that informs the canon. But I think the core teachings are very much about not gaining some sort of spiritual expertise in certain refined areas, but actually about living an ethical life that engages the whole of our humanity, the way we see things, think about them, the way we speak, the way we act, the way we work. All of this is the practice of the Dharma. And I feel we have enough fragments that have survived in these early texts that we can perhaps begin to reconstruct a vision of the Dharma which is not founded upon metaphysical truths and gaining some kind of illuminated insight into the nature of these truths, but we can begin to rethink the Dharma as basically a practice, as the accomplishment of a set of tasks. Hence my emphasis on the Four Noble Tasks rather than the Four Noble Truths. And again, I'm not making this up. If you look at the conclusion of the Buddha's very first discourse, you find that his enlightenment is described as having recognized, performed, and accomplished this fourfold task of embracing the suffering of the world, of letting go of our intrinsic reactivity, of beholding that non-reactive space that is imminent in each moment, which is nirvana, and from that non-reactive space, responding to the world in ways that are not determined by our greed, by our fear, by our hatred, and by our egoism. And I think we have a very sound basis here for developing a form of Buddhism that's let go of its Asian heritage to some considerable degree and embarks on a process of coming to terms with the sort of world we live in today.
You know, I want to stay with that, your fourfold task, and focus on one element of it that particularly applies to the second and third stages or dimensions of it, which has to do with the question of reactivity. In your presentation of the kind of goal of the practice, or one of the goals, it is precisely to become less reactive, and that the this lack of reactivity and the observation or the ability to abide in a lack of reactivity is also something you associate with nirvana, which is very different than the kind of pop culture or even reasonably well-informed view of nirvana that you would find in most contemporary Buddhist traditions. And since I think these ideas are really central to the way that you are presenting this material, and also I think are extremely important just generally psychologically, ethically, I'd like to stay with that a little bit more. So when you talk about, I have a kitty cat attacking me. When you talk about reactivity, what exactly do you mean? What is the reactivity that can be overcome or allowed to sort of disappear, or at least help be, you know, sort of reduced in day-to-day life?
Okay, I think we have to, again, I explain this in some detail in the book, and I'll try to summarize it. It's quite a complex idea. I understand reactivity as basically the kind of pre-programmed, probably neurobiological habits of our conditioning that prompt us, as soon as we encounter anything in our lives, either to want to get it, want to get rid of it, or else remain kind of indifferent and sort of disinterested in it. And The Buddha called these the three fires, and they're usually translated as greed, hatred, and confusion or delusion or ignorance or something like that. And it's interesting that he uses the word fire. Fire is something that flares up. And what happens when our organism, the human organism, encounters the world, it triggers a reaction. And it triggers lots of reactions. And again, I'm making a very clear distinction between reactions in general and reactivity as a particular problem that Buddhism is trying to resolve. We respond to situations sometimes with generosity, with kindness, with love, with wisdom, with tolerance, all kinds of good things. There's no problem there. And those, in fact, those kinds of reactions are precisely the things we need to cultivate, we need to develop, which is part of the fourth of my Four Noble Tasks. The Buddha, however, is primarily considering himself to be a doctor of some kind, a therapist. He's concerned in his practice with how do we come to terms with and how do we resolve those aspects of ourselves that prevent us from living fully, that prevent us from embarking upon a spiritual path, that keep us stuck, that keep us trapped, that keep us going round and round in circles like a hamster on a wheel. So reactivity is the term that I've used to describe this basic sense of repetitive reactions that are rooted in self-interest, are rooted in fear and greed and hatred, and that are triggered quite naturalistically and automatically on encountering the kinds of situations in life that we so often encounter. So the task of the Dharma is to learn how to free oneself from this reactive patterning that is so deeply embedded within us. And if we look at the early texts, we find that the Buddha defines nirvana as the cessation or the ending of reactivity, of greed, of hatred, of delusion. The Buddha also defines nirvana as something that is clearly visible, immediate, inviting, uplifting, and personally experienced by the wise. In other words, nirvana is something imminent. Nirvana is a possibility that is right here and now. When I'm speaking to you, I'm trying, I'm probably failing, but I'm trying to respond to you in a way that's not determined by my reactivity. I'm trying to respond to you and to the listeners to this program in a way that is freed from what I want out of this, from what I don't like about the situation in hand, and from my own kind of, you know, egotistic agendas. And to live from that perspective is to live from the perspective of nirvana. Nirvana is not something permanent, something that once you've attained it, it's there forever. It's certainly not some kind of mystical heaven that one day a good Buddhist will get reborn in or will die one day and then end up in nirvana. That to me doesn't mean a great deal at all. The Buddha was a pragmatist. He was interested in a way of life that was accessible and open to all people and that would make a concrete difference in how we live from day to day, from hour to hour, from moment to moment. Each moment in this human life is an opportunity to live up, to respond to the situations of life from a perspective of non-reactivity or nirvana, one that's not driven by fears and hatreds and desires, but one that is open, spacious, present, mindful, aware, that enables us to be sufficiently sensitive to what's going on in the world around us, what's going on in the life of another person that we're interacting with, such that we can respond in a way that does good, that realizes our values, that diminishes the pain and the conflict and the tension and the suffering in that situation. It's an ethical practice. Nirvana for me is an ethical idea. It's not a metaphysical or a religious idea at all. It's about opening up this space, this non-reactive presence of mind that's fundamentally equanimous, clear, tolerant, and living from that space. Now, again, that sounds like a nice idea, but of course the challenge is actually to train ourselves, and this is where Buddhist practice comes into its own. This is a practice that we'll probably keep on having to exercise as long as we're alive. What we're up against is hundreds of thousands of years of evolutionary development, all of which is directed primarily at getting what we want, getting rid of what we don't like, and ensuring our survival. The Buddha goes against that. He goes against that stream.
I'm glad you you talked about practice here, because what I appreciate about your emphasis on reactivity is that it really reframes what meditation is about. And there's a wonderful part of After Buddhism where you start out like the beginning of the chapter, and you're like, look, I'm not interested in, you know, achieving states of deep absorption. I'm not interested in psychic powers. I'm not interested in flashing, energizing my chakras. I'm not interested in lucid dreaming and out-of-body experiences, et cetera, et cetera. All of which are things that we often talk about in the show. We're interested in all sorts of domains of consciousness. And it really clarified to me the way that, you know, how open-ended meditation is as a category, as a practice, how much in transformation it is as we speak, that one of the things that's happening now, along with redefinitions of Buddhism and movements of spiritual practices into the marketplace, et cetera, is a kind of reframing on what these practices of these still practices of contemplation or meditation are really about. And so from this perspective of a focus on reactivity and on creating enough space around it to lessen its fires, to produce an open space of a different kind of responding, how does that shift the practice of meditation? And how does that also give you a place to sort of see what is more or less helpful about the different ways that people approach meditation and indeed this question of expanded or transformed consciousness?
Well, you see, what I'm interested in doing is providing a sort of a template for practice, a framework. And traditional Buddhism, of course, is that does that. I mean, traditional Buddhism, all the different schools will see the framework of practice as multiple lifetimes through different realms of existence, freeing oneself from craving that drives the circle of rebirth, and so forth and so on. I don't think that model works for most people anymore. What we're looking for is a kind of a template. And that template, I think, for contemporary people has to be one that is both psychologically credible, that is not requiring us to adopt metaphysical beliefs that for which there seems to be very little evidence, one that is philosophically rigorous, and one that is profoundly ethical. And I think we can find all of those elements in early Buddhism. We don't have to look any further. But in doing so, we're going to give a very different picture to what we traditionally think of as the Buddhist view of the world. This is going to be quite different. And I think it's different in the sense that it actually accords more closely with what the historical Buddha was trying to do. And at the same time, I think it makes this practice something far more amenable to the kind of experience that people live and have in today's secular world. So if we think of the template as a practice of engaging in these four tasks, for example, embracing suffering, letting go of reactivity, experiencing and seeing that stopping of reactivity, and then embarking on a way of life, that presents us with a framework within which we can then ask the question, what is meditation? What is practice? Now, I think practice, we can see quite clearly from these early teachings, is not reducible to just being a good meditator. It has to do with the way we look at the world, the way we think, the way we speak, the way we act, the way we work. All of these are practices. The whole life is a practice. But at the heart of that living practice is the practice of meditation. And I think at the core of this lies the exercise of mindful awareness, a meditation practice that is concerned with refining and enhancing our experience of what we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, feel, think, know within our own bodies now. And whatever methods you use, whether they're from different Buddhist traditions or non-Buddhist traditions or wherever they come from, provided that those practices help you to become more fully present, more fully alert, more fully alive in the immediacy of the moment that you're living now, and in such a way that you don't cut off in a kind of mystical sort of detachment, but you are fully alert and engaged with what's going on to such an extent that that can inform how you think and speak and act, then you have a different model altogether for what we can call meditation. I think this is a very liberal approach. I think many different forms of practice can get drawn into this. I don't think it's all about just boiling it down to mindfulness, although I do feel that that's very central. But I'd like to think that this new template for what Buddhist practice is in that broader sense allows us an opportunity to rethink what we do mean by the cultivation of states of mind, mystical experiences, if you like that term, that enable us to live more fully in this world. That, to me, is the key thing. I have no difficulty in accepting that one can get into some very extraordinary states of mind. That is not really disputed. But the real question is, how do those extraordinary states of mind impact and affect the way that I engage with the world in which I live?
Well, you mentioned mindfulness there, and of course, that's become quite a powerful topic amongst Buddhists and non-Buddhists. Again, recently, as mindfulness has become embraced by so many outside of the sort of traditional place where you'd find contemporary practitioners of Buddhism, and you offer some very interesting comments in your book about mindfulness, and particularly the question that's been raised by many self-identified Buddhists today who are in some ways threatened or are concerned with the way that mindfulness is developing as a process or practice separate from Buddhism, who see it as some kind of dumbing down or some kind of capitulation, or even more seriously than those criticisms. And in this latter one, I also think it's important to raise the issue, the degree to which abstracted from the context of a larger Buddhist practice or a larger Buddhist worldview, that these things can even, in some sense, enhance dukkha, enhance suffering, can even go further into something, a corporation that enables you to become a more efficient worker because you've adopted mindfulness practices where the corporation's practicing unhealthy things in the world. So it's a complicated issue, but you have some very interesting responses. So I'd like to hear what your take is on this sort of question of Mick mindfulness, as some people call it.
Yeah, Mac mindfulness. I don't take all this terribly seriously, to be quite honest. We live in a so-called capitalist consumerist society. So if mindfulness, or anything for that matter, becomes adopted in this world, that's what's going to happen to it. It's going to become commodified, it's going to become trivialized, it's going to become subordinated to other ambitions. That's just simply the world we live in. And there's nothing much you or I can do about that. But that's, I think, kind of missing the point. Of course, it can be misused. You could argue the same. I mean, if you want to talk about dumbing down, Buddhism has been in the business of dumbing itself down ever since it began. Is chanting Om Mani Padme Hum or Namo Amida Butsu not a dumbing down of Buddhism? Just chanting a phrase that is then supposed to have all of the magical benefits of the rest of the practice? I mean, that is dumbing down. Come on, let's get real. I think Buddhists are afraid of what's going on because mindfulness is being shown to be effective. Mindfulness is being shown, irrespective of whether you consider yourself a Buddhist or not, to be able to have actual measurable impacts on the quality of our human life. And I think this is actually an incredibly important thing. It's probably the most important thing that's happened to Buddhism in the 40 years that I've been involved in this. In other words, mindfulness has been discovered to actually be a very effective intervention in coming to resolve, you know, actual human suffering, not, you know, birth and death and being reborn as a hungry ghost, but actually, how do I cope with depression? How do I cope with anxiety? How do I cope with whatever particular issues are coming up in my life? Now, I find this utterly remarkable that Jon Kabat-Zinn and others have developed strategies firmly based on Buddhist principles that are now being adopted outside the Buddhist world. I think this is a very good thing. And I think the real challenge for Buddhism is not to get all sniffy about this and say that this is a dumbing down, trivialization, whatever it might be, which frankly is a reaction of fear. It's a reaction that, whoa, wait a minute, we're losing control of this. It's being taken over by the health services or by whatever. It's about holding on to power. Once again, it's about power. So the real challenge that faces the Buddhist community, people like myself, is how do we develop this further? How do we utilize this window of opportunity that's opened up? And frankly, it's not going to stay open for very long. How can we utilize this window of opportunity to secularize not only Buddhist meditation, but to give a more secular understanding of Buddhist ethics, a secular understanding of Buddhist philosophy, a secular understanding of Buddhist psychology? And how can we integrate ethics, philosophy, psychology, and meditation into a worldview, a world picture, a template that enables us to flourish as human beings, individually, communally, socially, in relation to the environment? This is a fantastic opportunity, an opportunity that I think needs to call upon the greatest resources that the Buddhist community has at its disposal. We need to move on this. We need to build on what's been developed instead of carping about it and complaining about it and pretending that we've got something so much more spiritual or metaphysical or transcendent in our particular Buddhist traditions or culture. We've got to get out of that mindset. I think the questions of human and global suffering are such now that we can no longer think of this as anything that's got to do with the preservation of Buddhism.
Well, that's a wonderful response. We have about 10 minutes left here, and I wanted just to ask a question of you that's my own personal kind of reflections that I think you'll have an interesting response to. I very much hear your call in many, many ways. I'm very persuaded by not just talking about Buddhism, but just in terms of spirituality in general, of in a sense bringing it into a more deep conversation with the secular, with ethics, with a sort of grounded account of consciousness, a sort of questioning and a skepticism around metaphysical claims. I am, you know, probably personally more interested still in a lot of the more bizarre potentials of consciousness for a variety of reasons. But here's the question for you: I haven't done a formal Buddhist retreat in many years, and I did them for quite regularly for many years. And I sit there and go, well, gee, what am I going to do? I mean, I don't have any active relationship with a particular teacher or community. In a way, it's kind of a framework of a possible community, a possible relation. And I see that there are forms of the kinds of secular Buddhist organizations and groups that you talk about. And towards the end of the book, you're very clear about some of the principles and some of the ways it's more of a network of friends rather than a hierarchy. And all of that I'm totally down with. I'm totally into the network path, the peer-to-peer spirituality. I think we're done with teachers with a capital T and certainly with gurus. And yet, when I think about where I'd really rather spend my week, I still kind of go back to Zen because the aesthetics are better, because it feels different, because it asks for a kind of sensibility, a kind of appreciation of texture and taste and the phenomenology of sensory reality that's called into a kind of more aesthetically rich zone than a lot of the more secular spaces that I'm familiar with. And I ask you that in particular because, unlike most secular Buddhists that I read, you have a very strong sense for a kind of aesthetic response to the world, what you call the everyday sublime in one of my favorite chapters of the book, the way in which just staying at the level of sensory experience of the ordinary world itself is infused with all of these, you know, more grandiose elements of aesthetics, of the sublime, of the great mystery, of, you know, profound emotion, of affect, et cetera, et cetera. And, but I find that very lacking in most forms of secular Buddhism, in the rhetoric, in the imagery, in the sensibility. And there's something that I find profoundly moving aesthetically about the old forms, even if I reject their politics and their sort of metaphysical hierarchies. And so I find myself kind of conflicted. And I think it's a conflict that you will understand and have an interesting response in the remaining 7 minutes of our conversation.
Okay, yeah, I'm with you all the way there on that, Eric. And this is a frustration I've experienced also, not only in my relationship with, let's say, secular Buddhism, but in my relationship with traditional Buddhism, including Zen. I spent 4 years in a Zen monastery in Korea. And of course, there is there, I think, a much stronger and more explicit recognition and valuing of the aesthetic. It nonetheless has become extraordinarily formalized and very predictable. And not terribly engaging artistically whatsoever. I think the real answer to your question is, where does the practice of art come in? And by that, I don't just mean the visual arts. I mean poetry. I mean literature. I mean film. I mean dance, theater, whatever it might be. If Buddhism, or let's say the Buddhist community, cannot articulate itself in artistic forms that are alive, that are engaging, that are imaginative, that exercise our deepest creative sources, that bring to a sense of this practice a profound sense of how extraordinary, mysterious, weird, sublime this world is and this moment is, then Buddhism will fail. It cannot, the vision of the Dharma will never be adequate if it is only left at the level of intellectual discourse or doctrine or psychology or philosophy. It has to embody itself in the imaginal world. And I work as much as a writer as an artist. I mean, this is not a very public part of my life, but in parallel with all of my writing, I'm involved with art. I make collage, I do photography, I make films. This is something for me that is utterly central to what I consider to be my practice. And in my later this year in Barre, Massachusetts, we're going to have a 3-day colloquium on Buddhism and the arts, which is the first time I think that I've been invited to get involved in this aspect of things. And I very much hope it's a new beginning. And I do feel it's crucially important. And I do feel a certain despair that this is not emphasized sufficiently and adequately. I see my writing as a form of art. I see Buddhism, the Buddhist, the Pali canon, I see it like the clay, the raw materials of my art. I don't see it as, you know, a body of hallowed ideas that I just have to somehow respectfully sort of reflect upon and interpret. No, it is the raw material of my thinking. And my thinking is the trigger for my imagination. And this is utterly central. And I very much hope that this might lead to what elsewhere I've described as a democracy of the imagination, that each practitioner, whether they're Zen or Theravada or Tibetan or whatever, finds as an integral part of their practice, not just becoming proficient at doing certain meditative techniques, not just becoming expert or articulate in Buddhist thought or philosophy, but how do we embody and actively and imaginatively transform? And transform is the key word. Transform these ideas and these practices into aesthetic modes of life. If we can't do that, we've failed. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, and, for me, that's partly what takes me back to the some of the original characters who really brought the Dharma full on into the West. And if you go back to the 1950s and 1960s and think about the Beats and think about that sort of that moment, is that even though there was a lot of what we call naivete or Orientalism or other aspects that were going on there, there was a kind of freshness in that moment that was bringing a profoundly aesthetic sensibility. And while those things have continued, there are Buddhist artists today, et cetera, it seems that the spiritually identified, the people who really want to work it as a spiritual system, transformed a spiritual practice, could gain something from that, from the naivete that's required to make an artistic act as opposed to a philosophically grounded or psychologically useful act.
Yeah, I think that's true. But I think it is going on. I mean, there's a book published a couple of years ago, a novel called For the Time, A Tale for the Time Being by Ruth Ozeki. Ruth Ozeki is a Zen student, a priest, I think. She teaches now at Smith College. This novel was shortlisted for the Booker Prize. It's a wonderful novel. Most Buddhists probably haven't even heard of it. It's a highly accomplished work of the imagination. It's going on. A lot of the poetry that is coming out from people like W.S. Merwin and others, Jane Hirschfield, all inform by Buddhism. Or not entirely, but Buddhism is a thread within that. And I think that naivety, as you put it, that freshness of mind is, of course, very crucial, but it's not something you can manufacture. I wonder if it's not the next generation who will be able to build on what we've done and come at what we've developed so far with a fresh imaginative impulse, one that we cannot possibly foresee. And that's the beauty of the arts, is that they're not predictable. They are, in a sense, at the very heart of what is incommensurable, ineffable, unpindownable in Buddhist experience, which I think is at the very heart of it, the very idea of emptiness of inherent existence or whatever, is basically saying fundamentally we cannot pin anything down. And if we can't, it's that inability to pin anything down that activates and allows the imagination to spring forth.
Wonderful. I think we're going to have to end it there, Stephen. I think it's a great place to end. I just want to let people know that stephenbatchelor.org is a place to find out more about Stephen and his wife Martine's work as teachers and authors, and find out the teaching schedule. And Stephen was with a PH. The book, again, is After Buddhism. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you very much, Eric. It's been great. And all the best to all of you out there. Ciao.
All right. Bye. And for me as well, to all you out there, keep your minds open.
Okay.